How did you guys form and mold your sound together?
Great question. We started this band after Joey and I both came together. We were on the road with other bands, and we were feeling kind of burnt out. We've been working really hard, spending a lot of time away from home, and we've been, at that point, both doing the sideman thing for quite some time, and felt like we just needed some sort of creative outlet where we were playing our own music, you know, as sidemen, we just kind of perfect other people's songs or play, you know, cop things right off a record. If you're lucky, you might have an opportunity as a guitar player to come up with your own solo or as a bass player to change a couple notes here and there. But really, you're just copping other people's parts. So we wanted to do our own thing. So we said, let's throw this thing together. And it grew way quicker than we'd ever anticipated, ever imagined. And in very short order, it went from being a side project to our main gig, and suddenly to this thing that's really affected our lives in every way that you can possibly imagine.
Now, who would you say is some of your influences? Because take it for what it is, but I hear just a tad bit of Jackson Browne in a lot of your music.
I'm now a huge Jackson Browne fan, but he was never actually somebody that we listened to growing up. Although I think we probably listen to a lot of the same music that Jackson Browne listened to, and also a lot of his contemporaries and stuff. But that California, I don't know what you call it, California songwriter folk thing was something that we just sort of seeped in. We grew up listening to a lot of stuff. Our parents were both really, really musical. Our dad is a musician, and our mom is just a music lover. And so we grew up listening to stuff like Bonnie Raitt and Ry Cooder.
Oh, nice.
And Little Feat.
Nice.
John Hyatt, Lyle Lovett. These people we grew up and really loved, and records that spun on the hi-fi constantly when we were kids. So, I mean, I listen to a lot of stuff. More contemporary things would be like Dawes. We really, really love Dawes. Their new record's brilliant. Jason Isbell. Blake Mills is a huge favorite. He can do no wrong in our eyes, and we all drool over everything that he's done and ever did.
Nice. Now, you guys are from Manitoba, right?
Yeah.
What is the music scene like in Manitoba? Because I always looked at Canada as like an untapped market. I mean, there's some like great music that's come out of Canada in the last 10 years, you know, that I've seen on the indie scene.
I'm probably and obviously a little biased and partial, but I think it's really special. Winnipeg especially, you know, you're looking at the country as a whole, definitely, but even Winnipeg just on its own, we've got something like 2% of the population and of the country's population, but 12% of the working musicians. So there's a bit of an overrepresentation there. I mean, you find it in any major market, any major city, but more so in Winnipeg. And the scene, first of all, it's cheap. It's a real cheap place to live. It's the middle of nowhere, but it's, you know, a musician can buy a home off a modest salary and live comfortably in Winnipeg. It's freezing cold most of the time. You know, we spend sort of 6 months of winter freezing our ass off and completely inhabitable conditions for like a good 2 months of it. And it just breeds creation.
And it seems like one of those places where you can leave your door unlocked.
No.
All right.
No, you wouldn't want to. not at all, actually. It's kind of a tough town.
Oh, really?
We were the homicide capital of the country for a while.
Wow.
In Canada, it doesn't necessarily mean too much, but it is a bit of a tough town. It's a little gritty. It's pretty blue-collar. We've got I would say it's kind of a tough town. But the scene, the community, like the of artists and creative types and musicians and stuff, is really, really warm and welcoming and really collaborative and cooperative, supportive, as opposed to some of the cities of a comparable size where you get guys really fighting and clambering over each other for work, for attention, stuff like that. This scene really helps. Everybody in the band, we all got our start because somebody is looking out for us. You know, the guy who produced our record, Murray Pulver, gave Joey his first real gig when he was 17. Called him up, said, "Hey, I need a sub. You're perfect for it, man. This is, here's your shot to play with some of the heavy hitters in town and make some friends." And that was really what launched Joey's career as a sideman. And I had the same thing. And yeah, we've all been beneficiaries of our peers in the scene. So it's a good place to play music.
That's nice. I think it looks safe for me because we're in Chicago. So
yeah. Okay. Well. Comparatively speaking, yes. Yeah, we're a little softer than Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. I think Winnipeg makes Chicago look like Syria. So. But well, you had a bit of luck in Winnipeg. You know, speaking of meeting the right people, why don't you tell us about how you hooked up with Bonnie Raitt?
Well, we have a mutual friend. There's this dude named Sean McCarthy who's been sort of our patron saint. He was tour managing Dwight Yoakam when Dwight played in town, and we got a chance to open for him, and he heard the record and asked for a copy of the CD, and has been sort of the angel in the wings ever since. He's been looking out for us and connecting us, and he had had an avenue to reach Bonnie and put a CD in her hands and said, "Hey, you're playing this festival and my buddies from Winnipeg are going to be there and think you'd really like them. You should take the time." And I guess a couple other people had made the connection for us too, and we were opening the Winnipeg Folk Festival, which is a really big deal for us. It's our hometown festival. It's a big festival. It's one of the biggest ones in the country, we had the opening spot on main stage, which was a huge honor and was a massive moment for us as Winnipeggers and as a band.
Nice.
And about halfway through the set, Joey looked stage left, and sure enough, there's a shock of red hair, and he just about shit his pants, and and he kept it together, and we played, you know, we played a show we were really happy about. And then after the set, Bonnie's tour manager came up and said, "Hey, you guys have a minute? Bonnie would really like to say hello." Like, yeah, I think that would be okay, Mrs. Raitt. Ms. Raitt.
I wouldn't have almost shit my pants. You know,
what's that?
I said I wouldn't have almost shit my pants if that were me.
Yeah, it would be like clean up aisle 3.
Yeah, exactly. So what did you guys talk about?
We just shot the shit, man. She was so cool. She was so classy. And she was just, you know, she was just another musician, and it really sort of broke down the wall. I mean, we sat and we shot the shit, and she's telling us about these recording sessions and stuff, and it was just like, these are our heroes, you know? And she was just, you know, they're just, you know, her pals, her contemporaries, and we talked about music, we talked about, you know, our girlfriends and some of her relationships. We chatted for a couple hours, you know, she came out after her show. I was like, "Hey, are your parents still around? Like, I heard they were here, and they gave me these flowers, but I'd really like to pass them on to your parents. I think they're great guys and whatever," and it was just like such a classy move, and that's exactly who she was. And she was hilarious, and we had a riot, man. It was a really cool experience. When Joey and I walked away from it, like, she and her tour manager was grabbing her like, "Bonnie, we gotta run, like, bus is leaving." She's like, just a minute, which, you know, put us over the moon. I mean she made the time to make us feel real welcome, and it was huge. And at one point, she, you know, she said, it just about knocked us out, but she said, "You know, guys, we've been waiting for you, you know. We've been waiting for a band like you." And, I mean, pinch me, I could die tomorrow. It's to know that somebody that we grew up memorizing her records, playing along and singing along and loving her music, and to know she's a fan, it's just, yeah, it's outrageous.
I've heard that she doesn't, she's one of those few megastars that doesn't realize, or like, it almost seems like she doesn't realize she's a star. You know, she's still a regular person.
Humility is something that you rarely see people faking. It's pretty, and I mean, it's genuine. I wouldn't doubt it for a second. And she seemed incredibly sincere. And I think that is kind of a rarity. I mean, an artist of that kind of note, or, I mean, just that seen that kind of success, it's hard. You have to go out of your way to stay grounded and connected. You can live in a bubble, and you can be so sheltered and removed from the real world. It's hard. It's hard to be when you work and travel and live like that. So that's an incredible mark of character when you meet somebody like that, and they're just like, I mean, she could have just been Bonnie at the supermarket for all I know. Any other person.
Yeah, so she could have been somebody that lives down the street. You
for
know?
Sure. For sure.
You know?
And, it's cool. It's really cool. It was encouraging.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's just one of those things. It's like, there's been a number of times in this short career that we've had where there's been opportunities to really take notes. And it's like, okay, well, let's remember that. You know, if ever we're at a position further down the line and we're lost, it's like, let's just remember how we were treated and what we saw here today, because that's sure as hell something to aspire to. And we've seen, there's been a couple of real important influences. A dude named Steve Bell has been kind of a role model for us. He's a gospel singer out of Winnipeg. He's a Christian dude, but very, very successful and very well loved up here. And he's taught us a lot. And yeah, there's no shortage of real, genuine, great people out there. And you take note and you think, okay, well, let's just, you know, keep our noses pointed in that direction.
Now, also, Trisha Yearwood gave you a glowing review. She actually says, wow, I hear so many songs that I love. They mix country, southern rock, and soul together effortlessly. These guys are making great music from the heart. I can't stop listening. How did that happen?
right? We're pretty lucky dudes. I don't know. We've got horseshoes up our asses, man.
Man.
The guy who runs our record label is a fellow named Garth Fundis, and he's probably, you know, he's one of the great record producers in Nashville, and he's done some really amazing work. And I think he flies under the radar. I mean, I didn't know who he was until after we started working with him and put his name into the Googles.
Yeah.
And kind of got pushed back in my seat a little bit. He produced pretty much all of her records, and so he knows Trisha fairly well. Shit. And I think he put the record in her hands at some point, and she really dug it, and then, you know, made the connection, obviously. So
nice. Now, what was the songwriting and recording process like for Let It Lie? Because what I love about it is that the songs have that loose, bluesy southern rock feel, you know, like Trisha describes, but also the band sounds really tight and well disciplined, which is an added bonus.
Well, thanks. The songwriting starts with Joe pretty much always. Some of the songs I've started, the only one on the record that I really started was Greenhouse. We worked on everything together. Some of the songs go way back to, we wrote, you know, 7-8 years ago. I think this is something we've been hearing a lot, but you have your entire life to write your first record, and then you've got about 10 minutes to write the next one, which has proven true. So a lot of those songs are cultivated from, you know, our life, our whole life. So some of them are older than others. We've done a bunch of co-writing with friends too. Murray Pulver, Dave Wazaloo, Alexa Dirks, a guy named Kevin Eichel. We've knocked heads together with a bunch of our friends and conspirators here in Winnipeg. And then we took the songs to Murray, our producer, and we flushed them out over a couple of days of pre-production. Took them to a studio in Rose Isle, Manitoba. Our friend Donnie Benedictson helped us record all the bed tracks. That was a really wonderful experience. We shut ourselves in for a couple of days in the middle of winter. It was really cold, and he spoiled us rotten, and we just got to mix some, you know, and under the best possible circumstances, got to mix some really nice music.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The same guy I mentioned earlier, Steve Bell, he gave us the keys to a studio in Winnipeg and basically just said, here you go, boys, have at her. and let us record there for free for a month, and we did the rest of the overdubs and vocals and finishing touches sort of at our leisure, which is something we wouldn't have been able to afford had we had to shell out of pocket for the studio time.
Man, I mean, that's awesome, because, you know, it's now everything sounds like an uplifting story of people helping people. You know, I mean,
that is our story. Absolutely. That, I mean, that, I'm glad you made that connection, and you're totally right. And that, you know, we are here because of so many people, and indirectly too, you know, people have just allowed this to happen and supported us, our families, our partners, wives, girlfriends, fiancés, patient, benevolent, wonderful women who've, you know, accepted our eccentricities and our rambling ways and stuff.
Now, if you ran into a band that, like, you know, let's say after you guys have made it to exactly where you want to be, and you run into a band that's in the position you're at this moment, what advice would you give them? Or what would you do for them?
Well, man, I guess it depends if I like them. you know, I mean, we've got, should we find ourselves down the road at a position of, I mean, if we're just still doing this down the road, if we're lucky enough to still be doing it at all, we'll have to involve a certain amount of quote unquote success. Very difficult thing to quantify, but, at that point, Will has built up, a whole whack load of karma that we'll certainly need to pay forward. So, would be a good time to call in some favors for any young bands that we might meet. And as far as advice, I would just encourage people to do it because you love it. I know that's really cheesy, but at the end of the day, and it's proven true for us, at any point, if you don't love music and playing music and making music, then you're in the wrong business. Because it is, if you don't love it, then the travel is exhausting, and the demands are stifling, and the pay is really underwhelming, you know? So there are all these other things that if you love it, you won't even notice. They don't factor in. They're not important. But if you don't genuinely love getting up on stage and making music, getting into the studio and recording, bashing your heads together over an acoustic guitar and writing songs, then there really are no other reasons to do it. But if you do, then you're in for a treat and a lifetime of satisfaction, because it's a great way to live, man. There's a lot to be. I mean, here I am. I'm looking over the concrete barrier into the Thames and watching the London Eye spin very, very slowly in London, England. On the Great Britain.
Nice. Well, I mean, I think part of it is you have to love it when it becomes a job.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about this with somebody else. I was at a wedding this past weekend, and I was chatting with this dude, and I'm fascinated by his gig. He's a production manager for a bakery that bakes buns for McDonald's, and I was just like, whoa, that's wild. And we were talking about jobs, and obviously he was, you know, being a baker, he was really interested in what I was doing, and we were swapping stories back and forth, and I said, you know, it's cheesy, but I don't feel like I have a job, and I mean, I shouldn't let the cat out of the bag, but I really don't, and it's been a long time. I've worked straight jobs, a lot of it, I have, you know, done that, 9 to 5, 40, 50-hour work weeks, busting my hump for a paycheck, and it's been a long time since I felt like I had a job, and he said to me, he's like, man, I wake up every day and I am reminded that I have a job. I don't forget for a single day that I have a job to go to that I don't give a shit about. Although I shouldn't say that he doesn't give a shit about it in case his boss reads it. I mean, he probably loves the job too in its own special way. But that is the truth of it. And again, cliches are cliches for a reason, but if you love what you do, you won't work for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Exactly. Now, getting back to Let It Lie, the album, I always ask everybody of this, and I got a feeling with you, this is going to be one difficult decision, but if you could pick one song off that album and the rest you had to throw in the fire, what would it be and why?
Oh, shit, man. What a question.
It's like picking your favorite kid.
Yeah. Well, it'll probably be one of the slow ballads because I'm a sucker for sentimental reasons. It would be, you know what, I think it's Nothing, the song Nothing. It's sort of the slowest thing on the tune. It's a 6/8 song, and it's one that I really had nothing to do with. Joey and Alexa Dirks wrote that one, and when he brought that one back and played it for me, I remember feeling it caught me sort of right in the heartstrings, and I can say it unbiased because I didn't write it, but I just remember thinking, what a beautiful sentiment, what a cool thing to explore. The song's basically about the idea that somebody's looking back on a relationship that's ended and thinking, you know, despite the fact that it's over, I'm just lucky that I had any love at all. It's a real kind of simple idea, but I just thought they explored it really beautifully in the lyrics, and then the song came together in a way that I thought was really cool. Our friend Todd came in and played this harp solo over the bridge that I've always really enjoyed, a little piece of ear candy on the record. I thought it was totally gave me like the lonesome cowboy imagery, some dude out on like, you know, cold Wyoming night, barren landscape, sitting around a fire playing harmonica by himself. So he's like, yeah, give me that feeling at the back of the neck when the hack will stand up. So yeah, that'd be my pick. That is a bastard of a question though.
That is a tough one. Well, let me ask you this. When you play live, what's your favorite track on the album to play? I mean, what gets the band like really excited to see that on the set list?
You know, it changes all the time. I think right now we've got a version of Runaway Train that we're really happy about. It's really, really fun to play. There's just this little outro thing that evolved out of the blue that has turned into something that we're really happy about. It was a serendipitous moment. The song ended. It was one of those things, you know, we always try and keep our heads up and let the muse guide us on stage. I mean, sometimes we play it down verbatim, and sometimes you get these little happy surprises, and we cut out at the end of the tune, and Joey and Ariel kept playing, and they started playing off each other, improvising off of one another. Joey was comping, and Ariel started solo, and then Ariel took over playing the changes, and Joey started to go. And it was this really fun moment. They're just going back and forth, getting in each other's faces and sort of pushing each other a little further. And all of a sudden they started to quote Birdland, the melody from Birdland. And it just seemed this really obvious place to come back in. Ryan and I kind of looked at each other and out of nowhere just popped, came back in and just made for this really exciting little moment at the end of the song when it was all wrapped up and it just kept going. And sometimes those moments you can recreate and sometimes just have to let them go. You know, it's kind of the mandala thing. Sometimes it's just it's an event, happens never again, but we're actually able to sort of corral it and we've been recreating it every night and but still keeping it as a sort of an open section. So there's a couple minutes at the end of that song where Ryan and I get to take a step back and just listen and just have our minds blown by how awesome and Joey and Ariel are playing guitar. So that's a real treat for me and a real treat for them because they get to stretch out and they go. So, and sometimes it's real straight ahead. Sometimes it's like, whoa, what is this? Like Kirby Hancock fusion madness. They get to geek out. And, yeah, it's fun. And I think the audience really likes it when the big crash comes in, the band comes in, you know, we come in pretty heavy and usually knocks people's heads back a little bit. It's really fun.
But I think that's kind of like the coolest thing about certain bands, you know, like Brothers Landreth, like, you know, is the spontaneity and the free form that some of the shows take.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy about it. I mean, I've played in bands before where you are expected to come and play down the record exactly. It's supposed to sound like the album. And I mean, when we first started, we thought maybe that's what we needed to do. And I'm glad that we've abandoned it, you know. And even the instrumentation is different. When we first started the band, it was guitar, bass, keys, drums. And now we have two guitars, bass and drums. And so it's caused us to sort of reapproach some of the material. And it just winds up being a different experience, you know. You put in the record, you enjoy one thing. And then if you come and see us live, you'll get another. And it'll also be different from night to night. So, I mean, for those that have seen us more than once, at least I like to think that we're giving them a fresh experience and showing off some new stuff. And we're always working on new tunes. We're always working on new covers. There's an impossibly long list of songs that we want to play from other people too. You know, you can only squeeze in so many in the set.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there any songs that you play live, either yours or a cover, that are 180 degrees away from the original version?
Nothing that drastic that I would say is totally, totally reinterpreted. We do a cover of Ry Cooder's take on Jesus on the Mainline, which is an old gospel tune. I don't know who did it first. That doesn't really resemble. That was sort of the starting point was his version, and then what we wound up with was something pretty different. We also do a version of Paul McCartney's "Let Him In" off of as a Wings tune, and we swing it and play it quite a bit differently. And I think the way we do it, you know, is. Well, it's just the way we took our approach on it, our stab to it, our stab at it, sorry. Nothing that's like, you know, you listen to it, you'd be hard-pressed to recognize it almost, which I get a kick out of. I love that when you hear a band play something and then somebody else tell you later, like, you didn't even recognize that that was blah, blah, blah. But no, we don't do anything that drastic.
Nice. Now, what have you guys got coming up? I know you're in London now. You guys are going to be announcing some shows in October in the UK. What else do you guys have coming up?
We are headed to Denmark and Belgium this weekend. And then we're home for a couple weeks. We tour through North America from when we get home until Christmas. We have the Kayamo cruise, which is out of Miami. It's a week-long boat ride that's going to be pretty incredible, and that's loaded with some just unbelievable artists. We're beside ourselves that we get to go and play that our job gets to take us on a cruise. It's not going to suck. Jason Isbell, Lucinda Williams, Steve Earle. Yeah, it's going to be a riot.